If you weren't here this morning, we had a look at Jonah chapter 3, and we left the situation there in verse 10 of chapter 3. When God saw what they did and how they turned from their evil ways, he had compassion and did not bring upon them the destruction he had threatened. What was happening in heaven at the end of Jonah chapter 3? We're not told explicitly, we're not actually given a window into heaven, but if we allow our imagination just to run a little, then I do picture a massive celebration taking place. We know from Luke 15 that there is joy when just one sinner repents. The Lord in Luke 15 is pictured in the parable of the lost sheep as a shepherd who says to his neighbours, "Rejoice with me." And so this is the rejoicing of God, as well as that of the angels. And if that were true for one lost soul, imagine the party that there must have been over the 120,000 or more who repented in Nineveh. But the end of chapter 3 didn't please everybody. The Lord was thrilled. Heaven was delighted. Nineveh no doubt celebrated and praised God's compassion. But one man was not on board with this at all. Jonah the prophet was totally unhappy about what had happened. And chapter 4 is the unfolding of Jonah's discontentment and of God's dealing with him. It's still all about God's mercy, as the whole book has been, but this closing section really contrasts the mercy of God and the lack of mercy in Jonah. We get, if you like, the account of the merciful God and the unmerciful servant. We're brought full circle at the start of chapter 4. The book of Jonah began with a one-to-one between Jonah and God. And since then, the story has moved on and it's gone through the seas. It's gone through the struggle with the sailors in the boat. We have walked through the busy streets of Nineveh this morning and spent some time in the palace with the king. But now we are back where we started, with God and his prophet, just the two of them. God deals in mercy with the masses, but he also deals in mercy with us as individuals. So let's consider chapter 4 together this evening. I think it breaks neatly into three sections, each ending with a question from God. We're going to look at, firstly, at the problem of God's mercy from verses 1 to 4. Then we'll consider the perseverance of God's mercy, verses 5 to 9. And then finally, the passion of God's mercy in verse 10 to 11. So firstly then, the problem of God's mercy, verse 1 to 4. I wonder if you know what C.S. Lewis, Nigella Lawson and Michael Winner, the director, have in common. Hardly a threesome that you put together to have something in common. Well, they have all declined honours from the Queen. There are a group of people, relatively small, who have done so for various reasons. But declining an honour is an unusual and unexpected reaction. We normally get words at the sort of new year when the honours list comes out, people responding such as, "I am humbled," or "I am thrilled to receive this," or "What a lovely surprise to get this for the new year," when somebody finds that they're off to meet the Queen at Buckingham Palace and to get their MBE. Well, we find an unexpected reaction at the beginning of Jonah 4. Verse 1, "But Jonah was greatly displeased and became angry." We might have anticipated that Jonah would be on a real spiritual high as we begin the chapter. He's seen the mercy of God at work in amazing ways. He's seen it in his own life through the salvation of the great fish. He's seen it in the lives of Gentile sailors. But most spectacularly of all, he has seen thousands converted under his preaching. An entire city overturned through the preaching of the word of God. But instead of rejoicing, we find Jonah in the biggest mood imaginable. So what is he so angry about? What has made him so annoyed? Well, the reason is verse 10 of chapter 3. He's angry because of God. Angry that God has had compassion on the city. The word translated displeased in verse 1 is a sort of toned-down translation. More literally, Jonah views this as an evil that God has done. He thinks what God has done is wrong, and he is downright furious that God has forgiven the people. Why should Jonah be so angry at God's mercy? Well, verse 2 gives us the explanation. He prayed to the Lord, "O Lord, is this not what I said when I was still at home? That is why I was so quick to flee to Tarshish. I knew that you're a gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger and abounding in love, a God who relents from sending calamity." This is the explanation for his anger, and we need to just unpack verse 2 to see what his complaint is. But firstly, Jonah was angry at the extent of God's mercy. We need to remember here who it was receiving God's compassion. This was Nineveh, the city at the heart of the Assyrian Empire. The prophet Nahum says of Nineveh, "Woe to the city of blood, full of lies, full of plunder, never without victims." Nineveh was a wicked place. It was a city that caused no end of trouble, and it brought destruction not just on Israel, but all the neighbouring peoples. And Jonah didn't want Nineveh to get mercy. He wanted God to send down fire and brimstone on them. He thought this was a nation that deserved condemnation. The grace of God, well, that should be reserved for Israel, for the covenant people. The reference to still being at home that Jonah uses gives us a clue that Jonah felt that God's sphere of influence should really be reserved for his people, for Israel, not for these violent pagans. And Jonah had been suspicious that God wouldn't see judgment through, and so it has proved. And he is deeply angry about it. The extent of God's mercy made him really mad. I think it's easy to condemn Jonah and think how small-hearted he is, how hard he is. But I wonder if we've got any similar tendencies or preferences for God to just limit the extent of his mercy. Would we balk at the idea that God might show grace to a paedophile serving a jail sentence? What about if God poured out his grace in revival on nations like Iraq or Sudan or Afghanistan? If God blesses churches from a different persuasion to ours, are we surprised? Do we think God should withhold his mercy from the charismatics or the hyper-conservative? Because in our view, they're not quite as faithful to the Bible as we are. Do we have any interest in the salvation of people in the Philippines or Peru or Portugal? Or do we think that God should be concentrating on Britain and the people here? It's easy to speak positively about mercy and yet have a whole load of prejudice just sort of tucked away. Some place where we would limit God's mercy, or at least where we would focus it in a different direction. But if Jonah was angry at the extent of God's mercy, he was also angry at the cheapness of God's mercy. Look at the way Jonah accuses God in verse 2 using God's own character. In effect, he says, "God, I knew this would happen. I knew that you're a gracious and compassionate God. I knew if I turned up and you saw just the slightest inclination of turning from the Ninevites, then you relent. Instead of executing your judgment as you should, you've given in to your grace. God, you are soft on sin and you are weak on justice. You speak about judgment, you get me to go to speak about it, but love has prevailed, as it always does." What is interesting here is that theologically, Jonah is bang on in what he says. In his copy of his Israelite systematic theology, he has quoted word for word from the section on God's character. It's truth that has emerged through the whole of the Old Testament, but particularly out of Moses' encounter with God in Exodus 34. But the trouble is that Jonah is totally unreceptive to this truth about God. He knows the theory, but he doesn't want God to be like this. It's no accident, I think, that anger is mentioned 3 times in the first 4 verses. The contrast between God and between Jonah is stark. God is slow to anger. Jonah is quick to anger. God abounds in compassion. Jonah has plenty of passion, but he has hardly any compassion at all. He may be the prophet of God, but he doesn't reflect God's character. He can't stand the cheapness of God's mercy. I think Jonah reminds us here of the older brother in the parable of the prodigal son. That brother also thought that his father had lost his senses and was way too generous. Do you remember what he said? When this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him. And I wonder if you or I have ever thought that God was a bit cheap with his grace. What about the Christian who is uncommitted or backslidden? They never show up for anything unless they need help. They never pull their weight in service and ministry. All they do is complain and moan. Do we expect that God should send them trials and difficulties to sort of teach them a bit of a lesson? If they do then see blessings in their family or in their job, do we resent it and think that kind of God's gone a bit soft, really? Are we more in favour of judgment than of mercy? Well, if Jonah was angry at the extent of mercy and the cheapness, he was also angry at the plan of God's mercy. We noted this morning that Jonah was obedient when he went to Nineveh, but verse 2 shows that his obedience was reluctant and grudging. He had gone, but his heart wasn't in this ministry. He suspected all along that it was going to turn out like this. He felt cheated. He'd done what God had wanted. He'd gone to Nineveh. But God hasn't at all done what Jonah wanted and destroyed the city. And notice how he justifies his past actions too. Didn't I say this when I was still at home? That is why I was so quick to flee. Gone is the repentance of chapter 2. Gone is any humility. Now he's excusing his original runaway. In effect, Jonah is saying, look, God, I was right to disobey the call. I made the right choice. Look how it's all turned out. Well, we can be obedient to God, and we can do it all with a wrong attitude. We can pray the right words. We can serve in some ministry. And all the time, just below the surface, we can be harbouring resentment. Surely there is nothing more miserable than living as a Christian, secretly unhappy with God and what he makes us do. Being in tune with God's will must be our attitude, surely, as well as our actions. Anything else just makes us miserable, joyless Christians, if we're not conformed to God's will, both inside as well as outwardly. But Jonah was also angry here in these verses because he had forgotten the mercy that he had received. I think the irony of his reaction and his passion for judgment is that it just ignores the mercy that he himself had received. Not many weeks ago, he was calling out for mercy in the swirling waters of the sea. But having been shown mercy by God, you would expect him to show it to others. From God's generosity to him, there should have been an impetus to show grace and generosity to others. Well, we can shake our head in disbelief at Jonah, but I wonder if we're any less prone to this. The parable of the unmerciful servant comes to mind from Matthew 18, where there was the man who had seen a massive debt cancelled and yet refused to forgive another. Christ certainly saw this as a potential issue for his people. And it does strike me that being unmerciful to others, forgetting the grace shown to us, it's a really easy, easy thing for us to slip into. Don't we allow ourselves to complain so readily about somebody else, criticising every little mistake that they make? We don't like the way they operate. The way they deal causes us some hassle, so we feel entitled to bitch about it to somebody else. I fear that in our churches we are prone to be unmerciful to one another, to pick on one another's faults, to accentuate failings rather than cover them up. We spend our time after the services complaining about the preacher or the organist or the elders or the steward or the person we sat next to who didn't talk to us. Where did mercy go in our churches? Where is the love that should cover over a multitude of wrongs? Have we forgotten the extraordinary debt that Jesus took for us when he carried our sin? Are we denying the very gospel of mercy by the hard way that we deal with one another? Well, may God help us to be a community of love where mistakes can be made, where grace can be found, so we don't harbour and foster the bitterness and the anger of Jonah. The church surely should be the home of grace, not the home of resentment and hard attitude. Well, Jonah concludes his rant against God in verse 3. "Now, O Lord, take away my life, for it is better for me to die than to live." I think his words parallel those of Elijah in 1 Kings 19 when he was fleeing from Jezebel, if you recall. Elijah also asked to die. But unlike Elijah, who was under the pressure of persecution, Jonah wants to die because he is unhappy with God. Basically, Jonah's only pain is unwanted success. He does seem to be a man with a bit of a death wish. Having disobeyed in chapter 1, he was ready to be thrown overboard, over the side of the boat. But I think it's hard to escape his selfishness in this request as well. Notice he says, "Take away my life, for it is better for me to die than to live." His request is laced with self-pity. And God responds to him in verse 4 with the first of the three questions in the chapter. The Lord replied, "Have you any right to be angry? Jonah, is your anger a righteous anger? Is your sulking justified?" In effect, God is asking, who is right, Jonah? Is it me or is it you? Well, we must move on, but let me just close off this first point by asking us the same question. Do we have any right to be angry when God acts differently to the way that we expect or the way that we want? Who is likely to be right? Is it God or is it us? If God is pleased, then we are not. Whose mind needs to be changed? Well, that was the problem of God's mercy. Now, more briefly, let's look at the persevering of God's mercy in verse 5 to 9. I don't know if you saw the story this week about the lady who paid £1,800 for a chicken leg. Now, that was a chicken leg that didn't come from Tesco's, not even from Waitrose, which overprices everything. This was Vicky Mills, who was 24, from South Wales. The chicken was her pet called Lily, and Lily's leg got injured. And Vicky has spent all this money on operations and vet bills. She's had to take out a loan. She's had to live off beans on toast to fund the treatment. But eventually the only option was an amputation. That's for Lily, not for Vicky, of course. But you'll be glad to know that Lily is doing fine. And she's learning how to get on with just one leg. Well, I expect most of us would say that despite her obvious affection for her pet, that she went further than seemed at all sensible. And verse 5 to 9 brings us to a similar situation. But this time it is God going further than seems reasonable. I think we wouldn't be surprised to see God grant Jonah his wish in verse 3 and be done with him and put him to death and get rid of him. But God doesn't do that. The description of God in verse 2 is absolutely correct. He is slow to anger, and he is abounding in love, and that's exactly how he deals with Jonah. But before we see God do that, let's just see that Jonah makes himself even more unworthy of God's mercy in verse 5. Verse 5 says that Jonah went out and sat down at a place east of the city. There he made himself a shelter, sat in its shade, and waited to see what would happen to the city. I want to just notice a few unattractive responses in Jonah. Let's notice, firstly, that the question of verse 4 goes unanswered. Instead of responding or repenting, Jonah's mood sort of hardens. He turns his back, as it were, on God, and he just stomps off. His body language here is the answer to the question. But notice also that he abandons his task. God had called him to preach in Nineveh. There were thousands of newborn disciples needing nurturing, needing discipling. Christianity nurture groups needed to be set up in Nineveh. But instead, Jonah leaves the city and he forgets his mission. We're told twice in the verse that Jonah sat down. The king of Nineveh has sat down in humble response to God. Jonah, though, the man who was told to arise and go to the city, he sits down in defiance of God. But then notice also he separates himself from the city. He goes out east of the city, away from it. He builds himself a nice private little shelter. One commentator describes it as setting up his own little one-man Christian community. He hated the people, and so he established his own little comfort zone, his own separatist movement, his own one-man independent evangelical church. And then, of course, he waits to see what will happen. He waits to see if God might send judgment after all. I wonder if Jonah really thinks that his feet stamping of verse 2 and 3 might change God's mind. I wonder if actually this is a kind of waiting where you know somebody is not going to do what you want, but you wait anyway, knowing that when it doesn't happen, that it will make you even more angry with them and it will help justify your behaviour. I'm sure we've all been there at one time or another. So four responses in verse 5, and none of them good. See what happens once we start to get angry with God and the way that he works. Once we start to deny the priority of mercy, then things just go haywire. It's a bit like a sort of novice ice skater sliding along. While things are in balance and the feet are on the ice, then it's all okay. But once the balance goes, then the arms and legs are all over the place. And almost certainly the poor skater ends up face up or face down on the ice. Once we lose our balance or our focus on the mercy of God, then we can slip off in all kinds of unattractive directions and usually end up falling on our faces. Well, I wonder, like Jonah, have we ever responded to a challenge from God by sulking? Ever refused to pray or attend church because God has not given us something we really wanted? Or have we ever set up our own little one-man show because others are just too hard to work with? I'm not really prepared to be patient here. I don't want to be flexible in this situation. So I'll stand robustly for my little version of the truth. And I'll stand outside the city on my own, justifying my small-mindedness as faithfulness. Well, how does God deal with Jonah? I think we can almost predict it now, can't we? It is mercy once again. Three times we read in this little section of verses that God provided. God provided the vine, he provided the worm, and then finally the scorching wind. God could abandon him again in verse 5, but instead he is going to teach him through those three provisions. Not all of these provisions Jonah will be glad about, but God is not primarily looking to make him feel good, he's looking to change his heart. It's all leading up to the question of verse 9. But the pathway there is sprinkled with God's mercy even then. In verse 6, then the Lord God provided a vine and made it grow up over Jonah to give shade for his head to ease his discomfort. And Jonah was very happy about the vine. The vine is given to ease his discomfort. Literally the word discomfort here is his evil. The same as the kind of word used for displeasure in verse 1. The words shade and ease are also related together. It's as if the writer is saying that the shade was given to shed his anger. God is removing the rays of the sun in order to start removing the anger of the prophet. The last phrase, though, of verse 6 is the most surprising that we've come across for a while. Jonah was very happy about the vine. This is the first time he's said to be very happy in the whole story. Finally, God has done something for him. God has done something for Jonah. But his pleasure at the vine is a really horrible contrast because he is seen to be displeased at the salvation of the city but delighted at some shade for his head. Is it selfish of Jonah? Absolutely. Is it small-minded? Yes, it is. Is it how we act? Sadly so. But we get vintage God again in this verse. Just when you think God should give him a kicking, he provides him with shade. God may well show us totally unexpected and undeserved blessing. Have you ever had this experience that when you're at your spiritually lowest, your most hardened against God, how many times has God just come and sent you some shade? even something small like this vine, just to lift your spirits and to ease your pain. Well, Jonah's anger seemed to be quickly healed in verse 6, but now his joy is short-lived. We read in verse 7, "But at dawn the next day, God provided a worm which chewed the vine so that it withered. When the sun rose, God provided a scorching east wind, and the sun blazed on Jonah's head so that he grew faint." The following day, the provision of the vine is followed by two provisions far less attractive, far less appealing, the worm and the scorching wind. The worm eats through the plant and the shade is gone. The sun beats down, the east wind batters him, and he grows faint. You know, persevering mercy might send us blessing, or it might send us trouble. God used both the vine and the worm to teach Jonah what he needed to know. We like to see, I think, that blessing is a sign that we are doing well. And we tend to take trials as a sign that we are not. But the truth is, it is not so simple as this. Surely the ups and downs of life should drive us back to God, whether it's in gratitude or in submission to him. Well, in verse 8, he wanted to die once again. He wanted to die and said, "It would be better for me to die than to live." He repeats the wish of verse 3. The loss of the vine on top of that simmering anger about the way God has dealt with Nineveh, now it's enough to break him, and he wants out. And God's response comes in verse 9, the second question God poses to Jonah. But God said to Jonah, "Do you have any right to be angry about the vine?" If question one was, who is right, Jonah, me or you? Then question two focuses on, is it right to be angry over a vine, over something so petty? This is a challenge to Jonah about his selfishness and his priorities. Well, God is going to nail this in the closing verses. But before he does, Jonah provides his stubborn response in verse 9. "I do," he said, "I am angry enough to die." And this must be Jonah's low point in the whole story, lower even than the depths he got to in the fish's stomach. Despite the ongoing patience of God, Jonah seems to be more hardened than ever in his anger. And it's a dangerous place for us to get to. Anger at God has become anger at a plant. Now even petty things are provoking him. We need to check our anger quickly, don't we, before we allow it to grow and to fester. Allow unmerciful behaviour in what we think are reasonable circumstances. We may soon find it bursting out all over the place. Tolerate what we think is justified anger, and soon it might be raising its head at every little annoyance. It is not easy to be righteously angry. I think most of our anger needs to be repented of before it gets out of hand, as it did with Jonah. Well, we have seen the problem of God's mercy and the persevering of God's mercy, but let's come finally to the passion of God's mercy, verse 10 to 11. Chapter 4 closes, as chapter 3 did, with God's compassion shining through it. Verse 10 and 11 are the contrast between God's concerns and the concerns of Jonah. We get Jonah's first in verse 10. "But the Lord said, 'You have been concerned about this vine, though you did not tend it or make it grow. It sprang up overnight and it died overnight.'" Jonah has been concerned about a vine, not because of pity for the vine, but pity for himself. He's concerned about its loss because of the impact on him, the loss of its shade, the resulting headache with the sun beating down. He was bothered about his own comfort. He had no lasting relationship with the vine. It was a one-day wonder. It was gone overnight. He wasn't responsible for it. He didn't tend it. He didn't make it grow. It wasn't even that he'd invested in it. The word translated died here in verse 10 is translated perish in chapter 3, verse 9. The simple summary of this verse is really that he is more bothered about the perishing of the plant than he is about the perishing of the city. So much for Jonah. What about God's concern? We get that in verse 11. But Nineveh has more than 120,000 people who cannot tell their right hand from their left, and many cattle as well. Should I not be concerned about that great city? And God multiplies up the reasonableness of his mercy to Jonah. He's provoking Jonah into recognizing why God will be so merciful. He mentions, of course, the great numbers, the 120,000. But he talks also about those who cannot tell their right hand from their left. A reference, I think, that appears to be to the children in the city. And he even mentions the cattle. And I think God picks out those two groups in particular, the children and the animals, for a couple of reasons. Firstly, I think because they are the innocent. Jonah would condemn the whole city for the violence of the adults, but God reminds him of two groups that, even from Jonah's perspective, shouldn't be as guilty of judgment, the children and the animals. But secondly, these groups are also the least valuable to God. Let me just explain that. The animals and the children wouldn't serve God directly as the adults would. From the adult population, there would be those who would be serving as church leaders and youth workers in the new Nineveh church, but not the children and the animals. They, if you like, were unnecessary beneficiaries of mercy. They were not going to be key instruments in serving God, at least not in the near future. Jonah showed pity for something, for the vine, because it benefited him. God shows mercy for the sake of showing mercy. It is selfless, this concern from God. The book ends with the final question. God says, should I not be concerned about that great city? And this is the final challenge to Jonah, and of course the final challenge to us. It's an unanswered question, and it means it's one that sort of begs us to face its challenge. The implied answer is, of course, yes, as a God who is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in love, you should be concerned. We don't know, of course, how Jonah responded. We're not told. The question is just left hanging for us to consider. And so let's consider it as we close. I wonder if we're reflecting God's concerns. Where do our priorities lie today? Are we bothered about personal comfort or having pity for those who are perishing? I titled this closing section, The Passion of God's Mercy. Let me just show you that passion. The word translated concerned here, should I not be concerned about that great city, is a Hebrew word that literally means tears in one's eyes. So verse 11 could read, should I not have tears in my eyes over that great city? Jumps us forward to the Lord Jesus Christ. There was another city that the Lord shed his tears over. In Luke 19:41, it says of Jesus that as he approached Jerusalem, he wept over it. And he said, if you, even you, had only known on this day what would bring you peace. Christ wept over a city. He longed for them to find mercy and peace, knowing that 7 days later they would put him to death. What mercy in the heart of the Son of God. What intense longing to show pardon. What compassion to those who didn't deserve it. What great mercy from God. Tonight, God is as merciful as he ever was. Today, we've watched him be merciful to Ninevites and even to stubborn, hard-nosed Jonah. And his mercy is still reaching out to people. He still weeps over London and Birmingham and Manchester and Southampton. He didn't spare his own son, but he sent him into the world to be the sin bearer and to take his own fierce anger against sin. His heart beats in mercy for people to turn and be saved. That is the passion in the heart of God tonight. So what about yours and mine? Are we so wrapped up in self-pity and desires for our own comfort, for personal vindication, that we have no time for tears? Do we pass the people in the streets and despise their simple lives? Or are we on our knees, pleading for God to dispense his mercy? We can so easily spend our passion and even our prayers on the insignificant, things that will take our energy, things that will take our focus, worrying about the vines in our own lives, and we miss the 120,000 people lost and ignorant and desperately in need of God's mercy. Friends, will we give ourselves in mercy to others? Will we show mercy as tremendous mercy has been shown to us? Should we not have compassion on this great city of Southampton? The heart of God beats in mercy. Are we sharing the same heartbeat of mercy to others? Well, may it be so, for his name's sake. Amen.